The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Pippa Carrera. 71 people died in the Grenfell Tower fire last June. Next week, the public inquiry will begin taking evidence from survivors, emergency responders, and expert witnesses. It will look at the causes of the fire and the lessons to be learned. But can it deliver justice? Also this week, should voters have to prove they understand the issues before casting their ballots? It's one of the radical solutions to boosting democracy across the globe from a new book by Dambisa Moyo.
In the aftermath of the Brexit referendum, there's belief that the most Googled question was, what is the EU? And I think those types of things are quite disconcerting.
And as the SNP prepares to elect a new deputy leader, we look at a race that has been dominated by one question. When should Scotland next vote on independence?
Probably because we're at a bit of a crossroads now. We're nearly at Brexit, and you can see the Yes movement sort of lifting all across the country now. It's time now to start thinking, right, where do we go from here?
But first, Judge Sir Martin Murbeck will begin taking evidence from families on Monday in the Grenfell Tower inquiry. It aims to establish the facts of the fire and will eventually make recommendations to prevent a similar tragedy ever happening again. But some have concerns, including Labour MP David Lammy, who voiced his in Parliament this week.
The people have been badly let down. Of course there is deep mistrust of authority within the community. Of course they have no faith in the state and the establishment. If the government loses sight of who this inquiry is for, then it ceases to become an inquiry. It becomes a talking shop. It becomes an exercise in spin. It is up to the inquiry to ask tough questions and interrogate the authorities on behalf of the Grenfell families.
Well, I'm joined in the studio by the Guardian reporter Robert Booth, the director of inquest Deborah Coles, and our columnist Dawn Foster. Rob, it's nearly a year since that awful night last June, and this inquiry has already been beset by controversy. Does it have now, finally, a clear sense of purpose that's agreed by all sides?
I think that the things have got calmer for the inquiry as it's about to start. It could have been worse, this. There seems to have been an increasing level of confidence amongst some in the community that the inquiry is going to get to some answers. And one of the key things, obviously, about that is the decision announced last week to have a panel of people who can help understand the root causes of the problem, the sort of political and community causes behind the problem. Then there was a big wrangle over that, and Theresa May had not wanted to do that in the first place, and it's been seen as by the survivors as a great victory. So I think that there's hope of that, but as we heard in the parliamentary debate a couple of days ago, that there is a sense that the inquiry needs to really be on the side of the victims and the survivors by cross-examining witnesses themselves directly, and that's still not something I think that the is going to be allowed. So it's in a better place than it could have been, but there's still more that the community and lots of politicians want to see done in terms of giving it teeth on the day-to-day basis so that they get real answers from the people that are going to be cross-examined, who are going to be the people that were responsible for the building.
And before we come on to that, the inquiry is going to take place in several phases. Can you explain a bit more about why that is?
Well, the first phase, they've decided to run in a hotel in the borough of Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea, and that's going to be 9 days or thereabouts of testimonies and tributes to the people who perished in the fire a year ago by the people who know them and love them most. So that's going to be obviously very highly charged and emotional, and I think the idea really is that it kind of sets the tone for what then is going to be a very long inquiry. I mean, the timetable that they've released so far for the first phase pretty much gets you to the end of this year, and that's without any slippage. And then the substantial second part, which is really looking into the build-up to the fire. So the first part is what happened on the night, the testimonies of the survivors, the testimonies of the firefighters. And the second part is, which probably won't really start until the back end of this year or the beginning of 2020, 19 is looking at the, you know, the build up to the fire, so the construction and the procurement decisions and the politics around that. So you can see that running well into 2020. So there's a long haul ahead for everybody that's engaged in this.
And Dawn, in those two separate parts, what do you think the main lines of inquiry are going to be?
I think obviously, initially, as Robert said, a lot of people were very, very concerned about the fact that Theresa May seemed to want a very, very narrow inquiry looking at exactly what happened on the night of the fire, but not really the kind of social implications that led to the cause of the fire. So I think that there's hope that they're broadening out. I think a lot of people want to hear precisely what went on, as Robert said, in procurement, but also in how the tenant management organisation was run and how the decision to outsource it went. I mean, one of the big issues leading up to the fire was that every time a complaint was made, it was referred to the TMO, back to the council, and the council referred it back to the TMO.
And the so-called bigger picture stuff, the stuff that will be looked at in the second part, the second phase of the inquiry.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good thing. A lot of people were very, very worried that it was going to look very specifically at the tower and not about social housing, about gentrification, about a lot of the issues. I mean, when I spoke to a lot of the survivors immediately afterwards, when I spoke to people who lived in the community, a lot of them said that they felt over and over again that every time that they spoke to the council or dealt with the council in any way, they were treated as though they were guests in the borough and they should be happy to be there whatsoever. And that's a really, really big problem we're seeing across London in lots of big cities in the UK. So I think a lot of people are really, really desperate for this to be addressed and to look at how, you know, gentrification isn't a benign, purely economic thing. It has huge social consequences and can really, really hurt people's lives.
And Deborah, you've been calling for months now for the inquiry for the families and the survivors to have greater input. Do you think enough has been done so far to bring them on board?
No, in short. I mean, I think what's been so shocking about the way in which this inquiry has started and has continued is the fact that at every stage, bereaved and traumatised people have had to fight to be at the heart of this inquiry. Everything that has been gained is as a result of those families coming together and demanding access to justice, from Pen Portraits, which will open the inquiry next week, through to decisions about having a panel. And I think what concerns me is that, you know, in 2017-18, when we're going to have probably one of the most significant inquiries in modern times, you know, human suffering, deaths on such a monumental scale. And I think people who are living in tower blocks around the country who are feeling unsafe in their homes are looking to this inquiry to deliver answers. And it has an enormous task on its hands. And I do think that when governments set up inquiries like this, they should, at the first instance, have regard to the community affected and the importance of trust and confidence in the inquiry process, which has been lacking. I think that the decision last week to appoint panel members has gone some way to giving the inquiry some legitimacy in the eyes of those affected. But I think it remains to be seen how far the inquiry may need to go in order to deliver what those families need. And every family that I've ever worked to who's been bereaved in really kind of shocking circumstances involving questions about state and corporate accountability say that their main motivation about going through these processes, which are incredibly distressing, and as we know, this is going to be a protracted process, it will last many years, but they're engaging in this process because they want the answers, they want the truth, they want justice, and they want wrongdoing to be exposed and those held to account for that. But most significantly, they don't want it to happen again.
So, Dawn, some of those questions that the families most want answered, what does the inquiry need to deliver for them? What are those questions?
A lot of what, you know, the people I've spoken to want to know is precisely why every time issues were raised, they weren't dealt with properly. I think a lot of it is about the attitude that both the TMO and the council had towards people who lived in the tower, but also the wider community. The wider community still feel very, very scarred by this, and the survivors, you know, are still at this point really struggling. And also, as well as the council and TMO, there are a lot of questions about what the government did and didn't do. They want to know why, for instance, a lot of laws changed in kind of 2010, 2012, that changed a lot of building regulations. And they want to know why, for instance, the consultation on the cladding was so complex, and why it changed so often, and why they couldn't have as much input as they wanted. And obviously, I live in a low-rise tower block, but you do expect to be safe. You do expect that the law will protect you, and that you live in a place that shouldn't burn down. And if it does catch fire, everybody will do everything in their power to rescue you. And that just didn't happen on the night. So obviously they want to know exactly why things led up to the situation, but also why so many people did die when something did go wrong, and also whether or not it can happen again. You know, people are telling me that they're worried about people who do live in tower blocks now, about whether or not they feel safe putting their children to bed at night.
And Deborah, at the end of this all, the judge is going to come up with a series of recommendations. How can we make sure that they don't just sit on a shelf and gather dust?
I mean, that is the crucial question. I think we need to remind ourselves of the Lacanole House fire in 2009, which resulted in investigations and an inquest and recommendations that were supposed to change fire safety. And if implemented, we may well not have seen the Grenfell fire. And I think this is ultimately about political will and whether or not recommendations, when made, are actually enforced. And there is a real problem. I mean, inquest works around state-related deaths that involve inquests and inquiries. And I think our frustration is about accountability. It's about where you have recommendations being made that are potentially life-saving recommendations, and they have a tendency to disappear into the ether because there is no one national body that is charged with auditing and following up what action has actually been taken in response to recommendations. So I know that one of the kind of really key kind of demands of the families that were involved in the petition and the judicial review that was held into the panel was also alongside parliamentary work around the importance of having legally enforceable recommendations. And if this inquiry is going to mean anything, it needs to ensure that where recommendations are being made about preventing other similar fatalities, that there has to be enforcement and somebody charged with regular monitoring and reporting back to Parliament on the progress of those recommendations.
But I think one of the problems is we can't wait until the end of the inquiry for a lot of that.
That's right.
A lot of lives could be saved by changing the building regulations, which we're going to hear about this week, and you know, adapting the way that construction procurement happens. And that's all going to have to happen on the quicker and on the hoof. And I think sort of taking a step back from the inquiry, one thing is apparent to me is that we already know a lot of the answers to the questions that we've just been talking about, and it's come out in the last 11 months, and it will continue to come out, the realities of what happened, and you know, through it's becoming quite clear what happened, and the inquiry to some extent is playing a catch-up a bit on that. And I'm not sure, I think it's going to be quite a strain for the survivors going through it to sort of watch that happening in sort of slow motion when they might want things to happen a lot quicker.
And Rob, the danger of these huge inquiries is that process does tend to dominate everything, and that they can lose sight of their aims, or that you end up needing several inquiries like with Iraq or with Hillsborough. How can they avoid that here?
Well, I think Sir Martin Moore-Bick has been trying to avoid that by, you know, prescribing quite tightly there's five sections to the inquiry, what they are. And they go as far, basically, as what Dawn was saying about the political context. And I don't think he's going to go too far into that. However, I think that a lot of that is going to become kind of implicit in the evidence that is given in truth. And the scrutiny that's going to be on the, on the inquiry from us lot and others is going to bring all that out. So I'm not so worried about that, actually. I think that political part is going to happen in Parliament, in the public sphere, in the Fourth Estate, and there will be some change around that, even if he keeps things narrow and forensic.
But of course, I mean, I think you've made a really important point, Robert, about the need for action now, because, you know, it is quite clear that there are some recommendations that could be made very, very soon. And if there's the political will there, then they could affect change immediately. And I think the role of the inquiry, in a way, is also to look at what's needed in the immediacy, but then more long term. I mean, we work with the families from the outset around the terms of reference, because we recognise that, and one of the survivors has described Grenfell as a tragedy in kind of three parts. You know, people were failed before the fire happened, during the time it happened, and then also in the aftermath. And I think there's some important questions to be asked in the latter phase of this inquiry about the way in which the state, both at a local and national level, responded to those affected, you know, and families who are still housed now in temporary accommodation in hotels. So there are important elements. But I do agree completely that actually there are things that could be done today that could reassure other people who are living in potentially dangerous conditions around the country.
And Dawn, at this stage in the process, looking forward, do you think that the families have any reason for optimism?
I think that optimism in this point comes in stages. You know, when I first spoke to people, they initially said that they felt that it would be like Hillsborough. You would need a lot of things to look at, all the different stages. And I think that we will need something to look at how people were failed immediately after the fire. People are still being failed. I spoke to somebody this week who is, you know, potentially being housed outside of London, and they're very worried about it. And I think it's going to end up like Aberfan. I think there will be a lot of emotional healing that takes a lot of time. And I think that we will need multiple inquiries. I think there will be a lot of things that the political class need to do. I think that there will be a lot of changes needed to councils and building. I think, you know, I think Rob's completely right. We need to do things very, very quickly. I'm not sure we will. So I think that whenever I speak to people, there are some reasons for optimism, but no matter what happens, everybody feels as if they just have to keep fighting for everything. And that makes the grieving process harder. It makes the recovery process a lot harder.
And Deborah, finally, to you.
No, I do think that what bereaved people tell us is that it's very, very difficult to begin the grieving process until you know the truth about how your loved one died. And bereavement, traumatic bereavement, does get terribly affected by long, drawn-out legal processes. But we know that if families can get to the truth, and if they can get some comfort for knowing that things are going to change, that can really assist in the healing process and in coming to terms with something that has changed their lives forever.
You can follow the inquiry as it continues on theguardian.com. It's been a tough few years for democracy. Hacked elections, the rise of elected authoritarians, and a collapse in many countries of the centre ground. According to the economist and political writer Dambisa Moyo, it's time to start talking about some radical fixes. So Dambisa, your book is called Edge of Chaos, which sounds pretty dramatic. Are we really on the brink of something disastrous, do you think?
Well, so first of all, the book's main title is Edge of Chaos, but the summary point or the secondary title is How to Fix It. And I think that's critically important because I am fundamentally an optimist. I do think we are in a very precarious point in history. We are looking ahead and there's some significant economic headwinds that we have to address. Everything from demographic shifts that are quite considerable. The world's population is growing at a rapid clip. And in countries like India, we're adding 1 million people a month to the population, and we'll continue to do so until we reach 11 billion people. So incredible risks around demographics, but also technology and the risk of a jobless underclass, concerns around income inequality, the debt burden that countries are grappling with right now are all economic headwinds that I think are particularly problematic. But beyond that, we have all these long-term economic challenges at exactly the time that liberal democracy has myopia, short-termism, embedded in the political process. And so that mismatch or schism between long-term economic challenges and short-termism in political thinking, I believe, is putting us in this at this precipice.
And you talk quite a lot in the book about voter engagement in democratic politics and that it appears to be dropping. There's like a growing disillusionment. I mean, you single out the middle class, but obviously it's more broad than that as well. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there are a whole host of reasons that suggest that voter participation is problematic. I mean, of course, the mantra of one man, one vote is something that has always been an ideal of the liberal democratic process. And yet today, we have participation rates in the 40%, particularly for people in low-income brackets, it can be as low as 30%. And I've considered to be far off from what we would consider as ideal. There are a number of reasons for that. There is voter disillusionment, for sure. We've seen voter apathy in many polls. People don't believe in their leaders. They think the leaders are unreliable and untrustworthy. But also, I think just pure economics means that very often people who are indigent or struggling economically just simply don't have the time to sacrifice their work and go and stand in line to vote. And I think those types of aspects need to be embedded as we think of how to redress the situation.
And you talk about some ideas about how you could encourage more people to come out to vote. And one of the ones that really caught my eye was tests for voters, which kind of assumes that some voters may not have the knowledge required to vote in their own best interests. Is that's quite a controversial idea, that?
Well, it's not designed to be controversial. And you know, just to put a finer point, the book does offer 10 proposals on how to remedy democracy. And there are two aspects that I'm really targeting. One is the myopia point, which I've already stressed, this idea of long-term economics and short-termism in political thinking. But it's also about legitimacy. I think concerns around the Brexit referendum, but also more generally about President Trump and across many leading European democracies is worrisome because people don't believe in the results. One of the most commonly cited statistics is that in the aftermath of the Brexit referendum, there's belief that the most Googled question was, what is the EU? And I think those types of things are quite disconcerting. We want a situation where we have as many voters as possible voting, but at the same time, we want to make sure that the voters have some basic knowledge of how to vote. I do propose, I discuss the opportunity for voter testing, you know, as an immigrant to Britain, but also to the United States. I am required to take basic tests in civics. I mean, I don't think they're designed to be particularly difficult, but I think that they do show an important willingness to engage with the political process and understand the basic structure of how a democracy works. And I think that's quite important in getting voter engagement up.
And on that specific point, you talk about how you would, the way to level the playing field on that is to make sure that civics classes were taught at school so that everybody had the opportunity to learn. But that in itself will not rule out concerns that by doing this, automatically you'd be cutting off the less well-educated, the less affluent, and those with fewer opportunities, because there's obviously a massive divide in the education system in the UK, not least in the schools, but also that different children get different opportunities depending on their parents' capacity to support their education. So
yes,
by doing that, you potentially, are you not, putting those children at a disadvantage?
So I think that that would be a little bit too superficial of interpretation of what I mean. This is not about rewarding people for their education attainment or their wealth background. This is about people's engagement. It's about rewarding citizens for being engaged. People take driver's licenses. You have driver's licenses. They take driver's tests. And that, we hope, is not skewed to the wealthy and the educated. And I think that there is a way of designing civics tests to encourage engagement. And to encourage, as I mentioned earlier, for immigrants, you know, regardless of your financial background, you still have to take those tests. And I think that there is a way to design them to make sure that we have much more participation. The other option, of course, is something like mandatory voting.
Yeah, which in Australia.
Exactly. In the 27 countries around the world that have mandatory voting. Australia is one of the most well-known, but Belgium has that as well. Many countries around the world, particularly in South America. I think that that is a very easy way. They, of course, either impose a fine for people not voting. But, you know, you could also do what they do in Belgium, where you're not able to get jobs in the public sector if you don't vote. I think that that is one of the more direct ways in which you can actually enhance voter participation. And I think it's critical that we think about that, too.
Now, the public revolt against globalization goes beyond politics. What role do you think that international organizations, that the media and the big business play in that? And what can they do to address the problems that exist?
So I find that the debate around globalization and its failures is quite left quite wanting. I do understand why People are frustrated and there are lots of concerns about what's happened. But I do worry that we are focused on pinning the problem on something that may not exactly be the issue. Our politicians, in many respects, made the wrong decisions. We did win. We did benefit from globalization. The classic example, which Jack Ma from Alibaba has talked about, is about how the United States earned billions, if not trillions of dollars from globalization. But rather than taking that money and investing in infrastructure and education in the middle of America, the United States government chose to go and fight wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they burned through a lot of capital by making decisions that did not invest in their communities. And so now we have a situation where the middle class has collapsed, real wages stagnated, and there's real disaffection. And we see similar issues around here in the United Kingdom, issues around infrastructure that's been debilitated and people out of work, etc. And I think that people very quickly have pivoted to claim that that's about immigration, it's about globalization, when actually it's about short-sightedness in the policymakers and and decisions that they made on the back of the wins they gained from globalization.
What about the rise of alternative models to liberal democracy? Authoritarianism, illiberal democracy. We've had various elections recently in Hungary and Italy in Europe, and obviously there's things going on in Poland as well, where they have fallen out with the EU over some of their founding principles. How much of a danger is that to European citizens?
So I do worry a lot about the current state of democracy, and I'm glad that there's much more sharper focus on democracies, because I think we've spent a lot of time talking about countries like China and Russia that are blatantly non-democratic, and that's what my book is beyond that. This is really about democracies. What can we do to reform democracies? But, looking at countries that you've mentioned, like Hungary in the EU, countries like Poland and Italy, my deep concern is that if democracy is not addressed in some manner, we'll end up in one of two places. One is where we have a small, wealthy plutocracy that are essentially devising policy. We see this in the United States, where 158 families were responsible for 50% of the political contributions to the president. Presidency in 2016. But the other extreme, which is what I think we're seeing in Europe, is a situation where the middle, the center of the political spectrum collapses, and you end up with these extremists, either on the left or right, and it essentially holds the government hostage to constantly pander to the mood of the moment, to current mood music. And I think the risk is, once again, we have public policy that becomes even more short-term and doesn't think about the long-term economic issues and headwinds that are detailed in my book, Edge of Chaos.
And coming back to where we started, many voters of Trump and for Brexit will say they knew exactly what they were doing. They were being taken for granted and they wanted a big change from the status quo, and that's what they've got.
Yes, but I think, and I do think, the economic challenges were an impetus for the changes that we've seen. But I also believe that many, even if we were to adopt the reforms that I propose in this book, it would not necessarily have meant that we'd have a different outcome in either Brexit or in the Trump election. But what I think it would say is that we'd have much more legitimacy around those votes. I think we have seen that certainly the media was a little bit offside in terms of not being able to gauge or to predict what happened. And I think a lot of that has to do with the lack of understanding of the economic challenges that people around the world, and specifically in democracies, have been dealing with.
Dambiso Moyo there. Her book, Edge of Chaos, Why Democracy is Failing to Deliver Economic Growth and How to Fix It, is out now. Just over a year ago, the SNP leader Nicola Sturgeon called a news conference at her Edinburgh residence. It was time, she said, to request permission from Westminster to hold a new independence referendum. Brexit, she implied, had made it an urgent necessity.
In my view, it is important that Scotland is able to exercise the right to choose our own future at a time when the options are clearer than they are now, but before it is too late to decide our own path.
The following month, the Prime Minister called a general election in which the SNP lost 21 seats, including its deputy leader. Now, in replacing Angus Robertson, the party's deputy leadership election has become a battleground over the party's attitude to the timing of a new independence referendum. Our Scotland correspondent Libby Brooks reports.
I appreciate that deputy leadership elections in any party are not renowned for being the most gripping of affairs, but This election is throwing up some really interesting questions, not only for the SNP, but for the wider pro-independence movement in Scotland.
Three candidates have been crossing the country in a series of party hustings. Tonight they're with us in the Scotland Tonight studio.
So this contest has been so far really dominated by this question of referendum timing. We've got Julie Hepburn, who may not have a huge media profile currently, but she's favourite amongst many activists, and she told a televised hustings last week that she wanted to see a second vote at the earliest possible opportunity.
I think we need to get out there, launch a fresh campaign for independence, and start persuading a number of people across Scotland who are now more persuadable, because there is now no change option on the table.
A second candidate is Councillor Chris McElhaney. He supports a second referendum within 18 months.
It guarantees that the 200,000 EU nationals that work for NHS, for colleges and our friends across Scotland get a vote, and quite rightly so.
And then the third candidate is Keith Brown. He is currently Cabinet Secretary for the Economy, Jobs and Fair Work. He's the most senior contender, and perhaps understandably he's more circumspect about the issue.
Well, I think as the First Minister quite rightly said, we have to wait and see what the implications of Brexit are. At that point you can take a decision.
Aside from this question of timing, there's also been a lot of talk about how the party should deal with its vastly increased membership, which is currently standing at 118,000. That's just behind the Tories in terms of the Tory total across the UK. And there have been complaints that local branches aren't utilising this amazing human resource as well as they could, and that party democracy needs to change to involve these new members in everything from policy making to door knocking. So I took myself to Glasgow City Chambers to speak to a woman in the know.
This is the first year that we haven't had an election, so we've kind of been in this cycle of referendums and elections and another referendum and more elections.
Mary Hunter is an SNP councillor in Glasgow, and she says the deputy leadership race can help the party get its house in order for the campaigns to come.
It's important that we've got our internal structures right so that we're able to start campaigning. Well, we're actually campaigning now, but so that once we get into the kind of, you know, really heavy campaigning period, we're ready to go. Our members are all trained, they all know what they're doing, and that also that we have a very robust sense of the arguments that we're making around independence, because I think we certainly need to refresh the case that was made in 2014.
But what do new members think? I asked Sandra Douglas, an East Renfrewshire activist who joined the party in the wake of the 2014 independence referendum defeat.
I think things have changed a bit this time round. It's a deputy leadership contest that's a bit more lively than ever before. And I think probably because we're at a bit of a crossroads now, we're nearly at Brexit and all sorts of things changed now. And you can see the Yes movement sort of lifting all across the country now. It's time now to start thinking, right, where do we go from here? I am supporting Julie Hepburn. I see Julie as the activist, I suppose, because she is an activist.
It's especially interesting for me to hear Sandra talking about the Yes movement lifting all across the country. Let's not forget that on the bank holiday weekend just gone, there was a march in Glasgow, which I think was the biggest pro-independence march since 2014. There were estimates of numbers between 35,000, that's what the police said, and 90,000, that's what the organiser said. But it's still pretty extraordinary to get tens of thousands of people marching for a cause when there's not even an active campaign going on. I spoke to Robin McAlpine, the veteran independence activist and director of grassroots-funded think tank Common Wheel. Robin, it does seem like the timing of the next referendum is completely dominating this deputy leadership contest at the moment. Do you think it was inevitable that that was going to happen?
Well, no, because it could have been about policy and it could have been about succession. So there's no clear succession for Sturgeon. These could have all been factors that came to play. It's just that without it being a policy discussion, without it being about succession, for these reasons, all that's been left is for people to project their hopes on referendum in. And it's also the case that because we don't have any clear sense of momentum, direction, or a real clear understanding of what the plan is, people are using this as a space to try and push people into doing this. So, you know, when you create a vacuum in the independence movement, people talk about how quickly we can move. And that's inevitable what happens. And this is quite a, I don't want to say vacuous, deputy leadership, but it is a deputy leadership debate which doesn't contain an awful lot of content, and so people are projecting onto it the content they want to see.
Now, I think it's fair to say that there is this characterisation of the SNP membership, you know, which we know has vastly grown since 2014, as being, you know, absolutely gung-ho, desperate for a referendum yesterday, versus the SNP leadership, who are variously more pragmatic, more in the know, or even more feared. How fair do you think that is?
Well, my experience of the grassroots of the independence movement is not what people characterise. As with all things, social media gives you a very distorted view where more extreme views are the ones that tend to come through. That's not, I mean, I'm out tonight to go and talk to an SNP group. I've talked to this group before. That's not where they're coming from. They don't want to, they're not taking the kind of Culloden charge down the hill at all costs, dive into battle and fight the good fight even if you lose. That's not where they're coming from with this. They want to win, and they want to win fast. There's a lot of concern in Scotland, not only among independence supporters, about the state and direction of Britain. They want out, but they don't want a fight that stops them getting out. They don't want to lose. So it's not as rabid as is sometimes perceived if you just look at people's Twitter feeds. On the other hand, they're getting much more restless because the assumption that the SNP leadership have a secret plan which we are not being let into because it's so brilliant that they don't want to reveal it, that belief is in decline, and the sense that actually perhaps the leadership are just a bit directionless and don't have a plan, don't know what to do, that's growing. So there is a sense that the membership are now increasingly pushing for a sense of direction, but that hasn't crossed over into a, at all costs, let's jump out of the aeroplane without a parachute and we'll take it from there, which is not the mood that you get if you actually go out and talk to people.
Well, that's all we have time for now. My thanks to Libby Brooks, Dambisa Moyo, Dawn Foster, Deborah Coles and Robert Booth. Follow all our political coverage at theguardian.com/politics. The producers were Phil Maynard and Simon Barnard. I'm Pippa Carrera.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.